Welcome to The Sacramentalists, a podcast where the ancient Christian faith is brought to bear on issues prevalent in modern culture. We're your hosts. I'm Father Wesley Walker.
And I'm Father Miles Hickson.
And today we're pleased to talk to Dr. Joseph Capizzi, Ordinary Professor of Moral Theology and Ethics at Catholic University of America. He teaches in the areas of social and political theology, with special interests in issues of peace and war, citizenship, political authority, and Augustinian theology. He's written, lectured, and published widely on just war theory, bioethics, the history of moral theology, and political liberalism. And he's also the executive director of the Institute for Human Ecology at Catholic University. He received his BA from the University of Virginia, his master's in theological studies from Emory University, and his MA and PhD in theology from the University of Notre Dame, and he lives in Maryland with his six children. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Capizzi.
My pleasure to join you guys. Thank you for having me.
So just to help our listeners get to know you a little bit, could you talk about some of the work that you do at the Institute for Human Ecology?
Sure. So the Institute is set up in a way that it probably is really compatible with what you guys are up to. We're trying to inject Catholic social doctrine into our culture and really to help us all understand the requirements of human flourishing, how to achieve those things at the practical level by looking at politics and so on. So we have an undergraduate program that we've just developed over the past 18 months or so, where we bring undergraduates in from around the university and try to form them a little bit more deeply in their tradition. We have graduate students that we support in their doctoral studies, typically in the areas of politics, philosophy, and theology. We also do a lot of external programming that is directed at, again, kind of engaging the culture on, you know, important topics, informing people and educating them about how the church thinks about certain kinds of issues, or often very, you know, sort of specific moral questions, like we had recently a conversation on work, what is the kind of theology of work, and how to understand how we as human beings are in some sense participating in God's creation by our own activity through work. We had another session on vaccinations. You know, we looked at the morality of vaccines, because that's been a kind of surprisingly contested issue in the Catholic Church. So we invited some people in to talk about that. So those are just some of the kinds of things that we do. We're really pleased with where we are and the work that we're doing.
That's great. It sounds super necessary. So
we'll
encourage listeners to check it out by posting a link to the Institute in the show notes.
I deeply appreciate that. Thank you, Wes.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think to kind of start our conversation when we talk about war and peace, it might help to talk a little bit about the history of the idea of just war in the church. Mm-hmm. So the two sort of thinkers that get brought up the most are Augustine and Aquinas. What contributions do they make to the sort of just war tradition within Catholicism?
Great question. Probably the right place to begin. I think the first thing to remind ourselves is that there is an ancient, or even a more ancient, just war, right, sort of approach to questions of war and peace that Augustine himself is kind of adopting, right? So it's not something he creates out of whole cloth, but as we know, he is well-educated in the Greek and Roman traditions. So he's familiar with the way Greeks and Romans think about, especially Romans, of course, think about issues of war. And he then becomes sort of the central figure for the early Western Christian approach to thinking about questions of justice and how to pursue peace, basically the inevitability of war among fallen human beings, and the way that fallen human beings strive for the good of a kind of order in their lives, in their political, you know, communal lives. Typically, like you said, everybody kind of jumps from Augustine to Thomas Aquinas, especially in the Catholic tradition, right, or even Anglo-Catholic tradition. And that's in part, of course, because Aquinas himself is looking to Augustine as the primary source, or one of the primary sources of his own reflections on these questions. And then, you know, the next move would be, okay, you move from Thomas and you kind of jump to the 20th century or something, right? Or you jump to maybe a couple of figures from, you know, a little bit before the 20th century. But there's a lot, obviously, a lot of theological work that gets overlooked in that kind of narrative. As you guys probably are familiar, there's a lot of Protestant work, right, that actually does inform later developments that also gets overlooked. Certainly the sort of, like the sort of Grotius tradition, right, of thinking about issues of morality among states, that often will get lost in certain kinds of narratives. But what happens, again, as you probably know, is that in the late 20th century, mid to late 20th century, Michael Walzer writes his book on Just and Unjust Wars, which I think now is at least in its sixth edition. And around the same time, Paul Ramsey, a Methodist theologian, also begins to really deeply engage just war questions. And Ramsey does it by recovering the sort of central Christian insights into this, Augustine, Aquinas, and he looks a little bit more at the moderns. So the moderns have become a little bit more popular now, a little bit more important for this narrative. And I'm thinking in particular of Vittoria, Suarez, Grotius. Those contributions at that moment now have become a little bit part of a richer understanding of how this tradition develops over time. I hope that gives you some sense, Father Wesley.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think kind of a follow-up question to that would be, where would you see the just war theory going on kind of right now, particularly under the Francis papacy?
Yeah. So that's a great, great question. And it's a little bit almost of a loaded question, right, Father Miles? There's been a move, as you're probably aware, certainly since the late 20th century, driven by different kinds of concerns. And the move has been one that is concerned about, it's concerned about the totality of modern warfare, right? So there's a kind of historical presupposition that there's something different about the way wars are fought today than previously. Now, the most obvious difference would be just the lethality of modern weaponry, right? That modern weapons are just, right, qualitatively more lethal than weapons have ever been before. Often you'll find the claim too that wars involve total populations in ways they did not previously. I think that's a little bit more dubious, a historical concern. It's the kind of thing that the more you look back at ancient conflict, you'll see that innocent people, or people who are not participating in warfare, were as likely to be victimized by war as were soldiers, as were combatants. And that really, I don't think, has changed all that much today. I think it's, again, primarily the lethality of weaponry, especially, of course, atomic and nuclear weapons, biological weapons, chemical weapons, and so on. And then also some confidence that we have international instruments of adjudication, right? So international law and courts that ought to be able to adjudicate conflicts short of resort to war. Now, this is a long way of getting around to your point that this has increased the call, certainly among the modern popes, for arbitration, negotiation, basically for extending the timeline before nations make recourse to war, right? And in other words, they're really trying to narrow the window whereby the just cause for war could be found. And Francis is certainly extending that narrowing, right? He's also tightening this. And Fratelli Tutti, the latest encyclical that he just released, sort of indicates a kind of frustration with the language of just war, and he really seems to be trying to tighten up recourse to war in the modern era. Whether that's just a kind of practical, application given the context of things, or a more theoretical development too, that's the kind of thing that theologians argue about, and we'll probably disagree a little bit about. But it's at the minimum, it is happening, and it is a practical, it's at the minimum a practical application, given, at least those presuppositions that I just identified.
Yeah, I think that is, I think that that's really good. And I think that Francis's kind of shift towards trying to make it a positive emphasis, let's be peacemakers rather than an emphasis on war, which is a negative thing. Or as you said, you know, Augustine, kind of this, this thing that necessarily comes about because humans are trying to strive against each other in a fallen world. That's the way I read Francis's approach to it. But obviously you've spent more time in it and done more work with that and the other wider things going on in the magisterium right now.
Yeah, Father Miles, the one, so fantastic. I mean, I agree. The question is, what is a peacemaker, right? And this has been a point of contention, right? Is that those who are critical of the just war account are going to say something like, well, you've abandoned the peacemaking vocation of Christians. Christians are called to be peacemakers. The just war account seems to be departing from peacemaking. Even if you provide a rationalization for why you're now departing from it, nonetheless, you still are ceasing to operate as peacemakers. But those of us who defend the just war account, I think, in fact, are typically going to respond and say, no, we're not, actually. This is one of the ways by which peace is made in a broken world, right? So, you know, and there's argument, there's lots of argument to be had over this, and good argument, but I don't want to concede the language of peacemakers to those who renounce war, because, you know, I mean, there is a kind of euphemism of referring to, you know, soldiers as peacemakers, right? That we're aware of, especially UN, right? UN's forces. But there is a truth to it, that what they're trying to do is actually maintain the absence of open fighting, right? They're trying to maintain that minimal order that typically we kind of take for granted, right? But is nonetheless necessary for some kind of peaceable living in a fallen world, right? In a world that will not know full peace until the end of time.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
So that actually transitions kind of, I think, well into the next question we had, which is, when it comes to the doctrine of just war theory itself, what are the metrics that actually make a war just?
Sure, right. I mean, that's a great question. So typically they're broken down into sort of two categories, right? The jus ad bellum category, right? The right to go to war category. And the Latin is jus ad bellum. The Latin for the second category is the jus in bello, like the how do you fight the war? What are the means by which you are going to engage now in the prosecution of a cause that you believe rightly to be prosecuted? And the first rule or criterion of that first category, the right to go to war, is that there is in fact a just cause, right? You have some cause that is both grave enough and legitimate, right, in terms of moral law and in terms of even international law, that licenses you now to use force in order to vindicate it. At this point in international law, and generally speaking in most accounts of just war theory from a moral perspective, that cause has been reduced to the repelling of active violence, right? Active military violence against a state, right? So if a state finds itself being attacked or imminently about to be attacked by international law and otherwise, it can have the right to defend itself by the use of force. So that's sort of the first thing you look for. Built into that, right, even as I'm describing it, is both the criteria of right authority or legitimate authority and right or just intention. Only, you know, certain authorities, public authorities, those who have responsibility for the common good, so the government of a nation state, the UN, right? The UN actually reserves some of these rights to itself now. Only these authorities can actually make the call as to whether this is that kind of case, this is that kind of cause that we can now vindicate by force. And then the intentionality has to be peace, right? It has to be to stop the force from invading us, right? It has to be to repel that force and to bring about conditions so that, you know, that once the fighting ends, we won't resort back to one nation attacking another or acting against another. And then within that, there's the sort of how do you fight this thing now? There are issues of proportionality and what's called discrimination, or in international law, distinction, where you're supposed to only use force against those who are actually using force themselves, against combatants. And you're supposed to only use force that is proportionate both to the end you're trying to pursue, the repelling of force, and also proportionate to the action you're actually engaged in at that time. So even though you might be pursuing force, you could still be using disproportionate force, pursuing peace, you could still be using disproportionate force against, a corps of soldiers in any particular activity. And that's forbidden by international law and the moral law. There's a lot more, of course, built into all that.
Yeah, thank you. One thing that I think a question that people often have is, under those kind of metrics that you lay out, is there a possibility for revolution to occur?
Yeah. So you're asking about can a community sort of internally decide that it's being oppressed, right? That there's some action against it by its own government that is so oppressive, now that the community can claim the authority to say, we're going to fight against you. We're going to repel your violent activity against us in the name of peace itself. And the answer is yes. Most of those who have contributed to this Christian tradition have argued, yes, there can be this kind of justification, but it's very narrow. It's very narrow, narrowly circumscribed, which is no surprise, right? Because even tyrannical governments, right, there's a kind of order that they maintain. And we know, too, from the history of revolutions, that revolutions often end up much bloodier than they initially set out to be. So there's a kind of reflexive conservatism in this tradition, which is informed by certain theological claims that you find back in Augustine, right? So Augustine will say, in the City of God, that we don't really deserve much better, right? Because we're sinful. We don't really deserve much better than even governments that are themselves unjust. That Christians know that when they live in a system that is unjust or under governments that are even violent against them, that in essence it's a kind of opportunity for them to remind themselves that they don't deserve better, that justice is the full justice, real justice, true justice, is something that we wait in anticipation of, right? And in the meantime, we are prayerful and faithful and, we use these as opportunities as Christians to remind ourselves of these deep truths. And that's awfully it's not consoling, right? It's a little bit hard to hear that, but that also is kind of baked into this somewhat conservative posture towards revolution, towards insurrection in the Christian tradition. But there's much more to say about that as well.
Oh, that's really great. I appreciate your answer.
Yeah,
that's helpful. We recently interviewed Brian Carroll, who ran for president of the American Solidarity Party in 2020.
Sure.
And one of the points that he made, and we've seen some listeners kind of chat about this point to a great extent, is that we sort of have to work on our own moral failings as a country. In particular, he was speaking of how we've treated people of color. Before we can be a credible voice in decrying human rights abuses in other nations. So in light of a country's own moral failings, does it impair its ability to act with correct intention in other international disputes or not?
In a way, the easy answer to that, Father Wesley, is yes. But I think we'd have to sort of drill more deeply into how to understand that language of intentionality. Now, the language can seem awfully subjective, right? Like what are you up to? Why are you doing this? And we know from even as, you know, as individuals in our lives, well, why are you doing whatever you're doing? If somebody asks you a question, you probably number one, know, well, there's multiple reasons why I'm doing this, right? There's at least two or three reasons mixed together. I'm not sure which one is dominant. Often you'll have some sense of which one of those two or three or more they want to hear from you, right? You know, so you might provide that answer to them. And that might not even be the dominant one, but you just kind of know, like, that's the better one. That's the more moral one. That's, you know, the righteous one, the one they want to hear. So there is a kind of subjective component to this language of intention, but there's also an objectivity to it. Like, and it's measured to some extent by what are you doing? Like, right, you want to ask, how are you behaving, right? And let me give you an example, right? So I have children. You guys may have children, right? You're Anglo priests, you know, I don't know. So you've got children. You know that, you know, you punish a child, right? Your child does something wrong, you punish a child. And you know, your child or your spouse might say, well, why did you punish him? Why'd you punish him so severely? And you may answer, well, because he did something that I thought was gravely wrong, you know, and I wanted him to recognize, or her to recognize, how severe the wrong was and the consequences for this. But at some level too, you may recognize there's something else animating this, right? There's another thing. You were frustrated, right? Or, you know, it's your own failing, right? You know, this is exactly where I fail. And so you're more inclined to punish it more severely. And your wife or somebody may say to you, well, look, you know, I don't really think it was a punishment. I think, you know, it was so severe, in fact, that despite your intention, I recognize that the real reason you did this was that second one, or that other one that you failed, you know, it was your own sense of your own failing here. They can see it just by your action, what your real intention was, right? That's what I'm suggesting. And so even in war, this is true, right? That sometimes our action betrays our real intention. So if you look at, and this is something people have studied, right? If you look at the way forces have typically engaged other forces, and typically forces that are less like them, right? So if you compare the way the U.S. responded to the Germans in the Second World War as opposed to the Japanese, right? You can see, wow, I mean, there really does seem to be a kind of difference in kind in the way we prosecuted these conflicts. And it may betray, right, that there's something else underlying this. So yes, you know, in response to your question, I've given you a longer response than perhaps you wanted, but this language of intentionality always should serve as an opportunity for us to reflect on ourselves and really reflect hard. This is where Vittoria is very good. When, if you read Vittoria's, his like relectios is what they're called, on war, you'll see him saying that the prince, you know, we'll just think like the American government, right, wants to reflect almost like a third party on what has happened. Where it's almost like you have to stand back for a moment and say, what is actually happening in this conflict, and try as much as possible to remove yourself from certain kinds of interests and biases, and recognize that you have an obligation to justice in toto, not simply to, you know, your cause, right? If you're really about building peace, you have to think about things from their perspective as well. What are they seeing, right, in your action, in the language you're using? And we know this is exactly what's happening when the U.S. fails internally in rights issues and other things. The first thing other countries will say, typically countries with whom we are obvious competitors, like the Chinese, they'll say is, how dare you? How dare you speak to us about our failings when, you know, when X, Y, and Z is happening in your own country, right? They have their own perspectives on these things. So it's just, it's difficult, right? But that's the nature of life in a fallen world, right? That these things are difficult, and our own intentionality, our own is bound up with motives and biases and other things as well.
All right, great. I think another question would be, so the other tenets, you know, you're talking about intentionality, these other tenets like peaceful resolution, success, proportionality, they're fairly intuitive. I think now the question is about the soldiers who participate in war. That often comes up. So kind of a question to throw out there, to what degree is the soldier's culpability determined, say, in an unjust war, but where the soldier acts honorably in his or her duty?
It's great to sort of crack open, right, these other categories of questions, and we're just starting right with, okay, now you look at the soldiers, right? And if a soldier knows the war is unjust, he or she is supposed to refrain from continuing to act in that war, right? So the account, the theory is really a theory of action. I think that's the best way to understand it, Father Miles, and that's really what you're opening up is, it's a theory of action. And on the one hand, you have kind of like global or corporate acts, and then you have these many, many discrete acts of individuals. And the theory does not at all think of soldiers as robots. They are not, right? They are not just programmed, and now they go out and do what they're told, and they have no agency. In fact, even though their agency is constrained by military systems, decisions made over their heads, they are still existentially as free as anybody else, right? They still face this situation right now. What am I supposed to do? If they know, and by no, I mean if they know, right? They've reached a kind of moral certitude. This is unjust. Then they have to stop, right? Then they have to cease doing what they're being asked to do. If they're not sure, which is probably the situation of many, many soldiers, if not most soldiers, right? I don't know the morality of this conflict, but I do know that I am in a community that I believe in and that in some sense I love. I am a member of this, I have obligations to it. Then they are supposed to act, right? And they are supposed to act in moral ways, right? So the account, is still saying, yes, you should act in these situations where you're a little bit, where you're ignorant about the morality of the situation. You should follow orders, so long as those orders are honorable orders or moral orders, and you should do your duty. And do it well and abide the laws of war that are written. Any soldier in the United States knows the laws of war. They've been taught these things. They typically will carry around a card that tells them, hey, this is what you should do with prisoners and so on, and what you can't do. And they're also codified in international law. So the account presupposes the freedom of the soldier, and his moral culpability, therefore, for what he or she does. You don't get off by saying, I was just following orders. As we know, you won't get off in court either for that claim as well.
So shifting a little bit to the ethics of the doctrine.
Yeah.
In the abstract, just war theory makes sense to me. And Miles and I have gone around and around about this in at various points, but I guess I do have a question about its application. So namely, how an individual Christian can justify participation in the violence of war, sort of for whatever cause, in light of a cruciform ethic that characterizes the Christian vocation that we all are called to. I can kind of get there in the abstract, but then just actually thinking about it, applying it in particular instances becomes much more difficult for me.
So by applying it in particular different instances, you mean really how an individual Christian now thinks, look, on the one hand, I'm supposed to conform my life to the Christ who has the Christ on the cross, right? I'm supposed to conform my life to Christ, but what soldiering asks of me is the willingness to kill another human being, right? And there's no question that that is what is asked of you, right? And as I said before, sometimes the way that the just war theory is understood is, well, it becomes a kind of an exception to this, right? That the world is nasty, right? And because the world is nasty, sometimes somebody has to act with a little bit of a disregard for the rules, right? They may know the rule says I shouldn't kill anybody, but you know what? In this situation, I'll kill because I believe the outcome of my killing is superior to the outcome of my not killing. And I'm just going to make an exception to this and either beg for forgiveness later or understand that the exception is in some way justified by a better outcome. That is not the just war account that I think the Christian tradition advances, the one that we've been discussing so far. There's a reasonability to this other one, right? And in a way, it has a kind of acceptance of the premise, Father Wesley, that you just described, that look, this here's, it seems pretty clear we shouldn't be doing this, and we shouldn't, you concede. But, you know, by golly, you know, there's a nasty person at my door, or there's a nasty person who, you know, or country that's threatening us or whatever. The account that I think Thomas advances and Augustine advances is one that is really making the claim that this is an expression of love in a broken world, right? That in fact, it's not an exception to the love making to which Christians are called. It's actually an expression of that love in a broken world, right? That sometimes we do have to make judgments that are hard judgments in a world that is fallen. And go back to, you know, the punishing of, you know, our children, right? These are the same kinds of judgments. I've chosen to bring a harm. You have chosen to bring a harm to your child. And they can be like almost quaint harms, right? You can't watch TV, or you don't, you know, you go without dessert or something, but you understand it. Look, I'm now going to bring a harm on my child for some action they've engaged in. And sometimes it can be harsher, right? And it's based on a judgment that the good, his good, her good, the family's good, the good of instruction is good for them, right? Is the loving act to do. And that's the same idea here, is that life in community is a great good, right? That life in a community that we all share, you know, one of you is in Knoxville, the other one's in near Annapolis. I'm, you know, in, you know, Bethesda, Maryland. And we all share this great good of being people occupying a real place in a real time. And that good is deeply valuable. And, it, you know, and my expression of love to you and to others in my community can be my willingness to defend it, right? Even to the point of my own death, or to bringing about the harder part, to bring it, right? We can all say, you know, it's easy to sacrifice our lives, but even to bring about the death of somebody else who threatens that good, who threatens this community, is or can be understood as an expression of love. That's the claim. And I grant that it's a difficult claim. You know, it is. It's not an easy one.
I think that is helpful. I think that is helpful. I have another kind of horn to this question, and feel free to answer this or give a non-answer as you wish. But that is kind of the historical application of the doctrine. So there's a sort of abstract, there's an abstract part of me that says, yeah, this all makes sense. But historically, where I think, I don't know if this has ever actually been practiced, at least not in the way that the church details it. So has there ever been a just war that meets all the criteria?
No, there has not. But that's a little bit like, I mean, right. It's a great question. Often I think people understand it for the wrong reason, right? Life in community is not ever fully just, right? You know, that's even in the church, you know, in a lived experience of human beings, right? Life is never fully just. And that's, in a way, at some point we almost have to let go of that, right? And recognize, like I said earlier, like Augustine does, that full justice, the justice of which, you know, for which we long, is not ours to bring into being, right? And it's not brought into being by us. It's brought into being only by Christ. And that is a gift that he that God is giving us, and that we live our lives in anticipation of. So in some sense, life in the United States, life, you know, in Rome, the Augustine's Rome, you know, life in Jerusalem, right? Right. It has been an admixture of good and evil, justice and injustice. And even in war, where you have a just cause, let's say, and the legitimate authority naming the just cause, and you have the right intention, let's bring about, you know, a kind of proportionate end to this violence by the use of our own violence, you will still have injustice done, right? Of course, you will have commanders who look for the easy way out, right? Who use disproportionate force out of over-concern for their own soldiers, lack of concern for the enemy soldiers, lack of concern for their own soldiers, right? And you'll have individual soldiers who because of the fog of war, I guess you'd call it, right? The difficulty of war waged, and find themselves drawn into darker and darker things, right? And perhaps even enjoying killing when you're not supposed to be enjoying killing. So there will always be this. But now, in some level, you may just be saying, well, look, has there ever been a just war just in the more programmatic sense, like where we've actually had a just cause and we have legitimate authority speaking to it, and we really have a kind of measured response? That's a different sort of question. Typically, Americans will answer the Second World War. You know, I'm pretty deeply Augustinian, you know, to be honest with you, about these kinds of things. I think war does have a logic to it, or almost like an illogic, right? Like a perverse logic to it that really does draw all parties to it into, you know, worse and worse human behavior, even though you see, you know, enormous acts of great honor and nobility and sacrifice in war as well. There's a kind of momentum the thing corporately gains that becomes deeply problematic. But that's, to my mind, that the tradition is always striving to try to rein that in rather than license it, and striving to say, look, war does have this logic. Beware that your intentionality is not going to be corrupted by it, that your action's not going to be perverted by prior action, and on and on. So I kind of dodged it in a way. I'd like to say that, yeah, there are wars that have been just-ish, you know, right? You know, and certainly by comparison, other ones that have been deeply, deeply problematic.
It does make sense to think of it, I guess, or it was helpful for me to start thinking of it, I guess, more as a spectrum rather than merely an on-off switch. I mean, you might be approaching justice, but will that be perfectly attained? Probably not, but...
And you can always lose it. I mean, it's one of the sources of human drama, right, is that it's really hard to be good. It's really easy to be bad, right? Or, you know, it's... You can work your whole life, right, to be a virtuous person and fail in a second, right? I mean, before you even act, right? I mean, that's how Augustine describes Adam and Eve, right? The sin is, you know, is even prior in a way to the act, right? It's, you know, it's being tempted already, you know, that is already a slip, you know.
Well, that's great. Well, you've given us a lot to think about today, for sure. And so we greatly appreciate that. So after such heady conversations about war and peace, we like to end the show with something a little bit lighter, talking about what we're into, anything, a book, a movie, TV show, music, experience. So Dr. Capizzi, what are you into these days?
What I'm into these days, great question. I'm happy to get a little lighter, is farming. As I get older, my wife and I got a little piece of property out in rural Virginia, and I've been drawn to the farming life. I mean, I find myself more and more living my weeks anticipating getting away to doing some planting, typically of trees. I like to plant fruit trees. So that's something that's, that I've gotten into.
Father Miles is our resident farmer.
Oh man. Yeah. I've got 12 chickens in the backyard. We've been working on getting our garden going. My wife and I were just outside at lunchtime with our two kids, pulling up things, cultivating mint plants. We're drying out the mint leaves for mint tea, planting onions and tomatoes. And so I'm right there with you. So,
well, maybe I'll call you for tips or something, or email you for tips.
I don't know anything. I'm just making it up as I go. I do understand that dirt plus water plus seed normally gives you something to eat. So we're learning it as we go, but kind of a larger vision for our life is to move to even a larger piece of land, a little bit more rural here in Tennessee, and to kind of do it not full time. I don't want to be like a full time and it be my livelihood, but some sort of drawing, as you said, and connectivity, like a spirituality almost to farming, that there is a understanding scripture, understanding our vocation as humans all the more through a connection to the land. It's been awakened.
You know, it'd be interesting for you guys to even do a session that looks at, the sort of ethics of farming or something, because there are so many pressures on individual farmers, Miles, as you probably know. This is something I've learned, in getting interested in this, is that it's very hard for these guys to make livings, as smaller farmers. The whole game is geared towards large farms, really large scale farming. And then on top of it, something I just discovered is that there's a lot of pressure to turn farmland into solar farms, which I just think of as catastrophic.
And then there's the whole dynamic of the ethics of food production, food sourcing.
That's right.
I think that Christians have a lot to be able to say towards it. And Catholic social teaching, I think in the next couple of decades, is going to have a lot of application to bring.
I think that's right. Absolutely.
I'm really the odd one out here. I live in a townhouse with no yard at all. We have a couple of plants in our house.
It's a start.
So Father Miles, what are you into these days besides farming?
Yeah, sure. Well, as I've mentioned on the podcast a couple times now, I and another priest in the diocese have taken on the big task of over the next 2 years reading through Aquinas' Summa. And so I have reached the point in the Summa. We're still in what's Prima Pars. We're around question 70, 75. And so he's just talking about creation. And I think that his description of the 6 days of creation would really give a lot of clarity to some of the conversations that go on in various circles, more fundamentalist circles, about what the purpose of Genesis 1, Genesis 2 is. But it also just adds this grander vision of creation being God's intention of setting up the world for not necessarily humans, but for himself, and the pinnacle being his son, Jesus Christ, in creation. Just been into that, been enjoying Aquinas. It'll be one paragraph that is just beautiful and profound. The next paragraph I have to read four times to see if I even understand what he's talking about. So,
well, you're doing it in the Latin, of course, right?
Oh yeah, it is. What's the word I'm looking for? Bilingual. It's the dual edition. So when I don't understand the English, I actually do go read the Latin, because the English translation often just butchers the whole thing. So there's literally whole sentences that aren't sentences. There's like no verb. And I go to the Latin, I was like, okay, there's a verb. It's right there. I see it. I can parse it. Anyway, so that's what I've been into and will probably continually be into. So I'm sure over the next couple of years, there'll be even more updates on the Sacramentalist. Where are you in the Summa now, Father Miles?
So the what I'm into is also a medieval book, though not nearly as dense as the Summa, Father Miles. But I'm into On Grace and Free Choice by Bernard of Clairvaux. And I think this is a really important treatise. Listeners who are familiar with their Reformed church history will know that, Luther was very influenced by Bernard. But Luther himself actually makes a distinction between Bernard the preacher and Bernard the theologian, and he prefers Bernard the preacher. And of course, if you read Bernard's sermons, especially his sermons on the Song of Songs, I mean, you can certainly understand why anyone would feel that way. However, I think Luther sort of undercuts Bernard when it comes to his theology, and On Grace and Free Choice is a really good example of that. So I think this is a really helpful book with Calvinism and sort of predestinarian theology. I think that Bernard offers us a helpful corrective here, so I strongly recommend this one.
Dr. Capizzi, thank you so much for being with us today. It was a joy to have you on the podcast, and thank you for giving us so much to talk about.
Yeah, my pleasure to be with you, Father Miles, and you, Father Wesley. It was a lot of
fun. Absolutely. Thank you. Now, if people want to continue to follow you and kind of your work, is there a place they can go and look?
Yeah, the best place is to go to the Institute for Human Ecology's website. So just Google Institute for Human Ecology, and you'll find us and see the good stuff we're up to.
That's awesome. Well, thank you again so much. And as we normally end our episode, allow me to just say the Collect for Social Justice. Let us pray. Almighty God, who has created man in thine own image, grant us grace fearlessly to contend against evil and to make no peace with oppression, and that we may reverently use our freedom. Help us to employ it in the maintenance of justice among men and nation, to the glory of thy holy name, through Jesus Christ our Lord.
Amen.